Thank you very much. I feel a bit like Neville Straightman, I must admit. And I'm not going to mention GDP. Well, the title of my presentation is Measuring Community Strength. Next slide, please. And I'm actually going to move through things fairly quickly. I'm going to, first of all, describe some ABS work and indeed some non-ABS work, which is relevant to measuring community strength. Also, we'll run through some international work. I'll provide a few statistical results and make a few comments on the future. I'm deliberately going to go through this fairly quickly and give you an overview of our work rather than a detailed knowledge. Next slide, please. We have produced a publication called Measuring Wellbeing. Statistics on the social side or the wellbeing side are much less mature than what they are on the economic side. And we have produced this framework which has attracted a lot of interest around the world. And I'll just highlight a few things. There's a list of areas of concern on the left-hand side of that, the sorts of things you would normally expect. But it was really on the right-hand side that I wanted to focus, that in measuring well-being, we're not just looking at individual well-being, we're also looking at societal well-being, and of course communities of various types fit into that. Not only geographic communities, which is often the way we think of communities, but other forms of communities. Next slide, please. Well, first of all, looking at our work on measuring community strength, the first two things I've listed there are a discussion document which describe social capital and ways that we might measure it. This work is very experimental. There's nothing we can copy. We're, in fact, toward the leading edge of international development of statistics in the area of social capital. But there is a lot of collaboration, and the OECD is actually is interested in this topic and has provided a focus for some of that collaboration. All these first two documents are available on the website. If people are interested or if they want to contact me, I can actually arrange for them to be given a copy. We've also ran in 2002 a general social survey which included a bank of questions on social capital. In fact, we're going to repeat this survey in 2006, but add more extensive questions on social capital, and we've been collaborating with key users on what the nature of those questions might be. One of the advantages of the general social survey is it doesn't just ask questions on social capital, it covers a range of areas like health, education, crime victimisation, work and so forth. So it does enable people to study the interaction between all those different areas of social concern. And I must admit that this data hasn't been as utilised as much as what it might so far. So we certainly encourage the research community to work with us to make sure this data is used to a larger extent than what it has been done to date. We also ran what we called an Indigenous General Social Survey in 2003, and that also included a bank of questions on social capital, somewhat different than what they were for the non-Indigenous population, being a bit more sensitive to the cultural aspects of Indigenous life. But again, this survey does enable some study of interaction between social capital type issues and other areas of social concern. Next slide, please. We have run several what we call community housing and infrastructure needs surveys, or CHINs it's referred to in brief. We ran one in 2001, not long before the census, and I think the one before was about 1998. Again, we're conducting another one prior to the 2006 survey. This will be done in collaboration with Family and Community Services given the demise of ACCID. And this survey does focus on communities and the infrastructure they have, the services they have, or I guess more importantly, the lack of services. So it is a very important data source about Indigenous communities. The population census is, of course, incredibly important. Neville quite a few figures from the census. It enables us to profile particular communities, not just geographic communities, but if you're looking at communities based on ethnicity, for example, within a city, it enables you to do that and understand the characteristics of that type of community. But also the census does provide a lot of information on living arrangements, and as Neville pointed out quite clearly, a very worrying trend is the increasing number of people living alone. And the perception is that is driven by older people, particularly older women losing their husbands, but that's not correct. The real driving force in the increase of single person living alone is among younger adults. And we also run a lot of surveys on volunteerism and participation in social sporting events and the like. There's a lot of data there, and as I will speak about in a few moments, it really is necessary to have a framework to bring all this data together in a reasonably coherent way. Next slide. The 2006 population census, which we'll be conducting in a little over a year, will for the first time collect data on volunteerism and also on caring. Caring will not just cover caring of children, but importantly, it will also include caring of older people and people with disabilities, illness and the like. So that will be the first time we collect that type of information. I'm sure there'll be a lot of interest in it, particularly by the types of organisations that are represented here today. The next census will provide more flexibility in defining communities, geographic communities, I should say, because we will introduce another unit called a mesh block, which is a much smaller unit. In urban areas, you can think of it as a street block. Of course, in rural areas, it's slightly different. But it also, importantly, enables the linking of data from the census. Here I'm talking about aggregate data for these small geographic units with other administrative data sets, which can be actually classified to the same geographic unit. So it does enable a lot of analysis of communities, not just based on ABS data, but also combining with data from other sources. And the census, we also compile what we call socioeconomic indexes, which enables us to classify communities according to several indexes, including one of disadvantage and advantage, and one of comparative disadvantage. And in the next census, we will be able to improve the quality of these indexes in the past with the availability of data at a smaller geographic level. Next slide, please. We're not the only organisation that's involved in measuring community strength. The Victorian government has been running a Victorian Community Survey. There's a publication available here which has been released by, I've forgotten the exact name of the department. The Department of Victorian Communities. That's a very, I think it's an excellent study and groundbreaking work that Victorians should be proud of. There's also another very interesting exercise called Tasmanian Together. Again, this is a publication that's based on indicators. And the interesting thing about this publication is that the indicators have been mainly determined by the communities. It's the things that the community feels are important. And that's the way Tasmania Together has been brought together. They've got a coherent measurement framework underpinning it. So both these pieces of work by Australian states are excellent, groundbreaking work that have attracted interest around other parts of the world. And there's also a number of other inquiries into social capital. I'm familiar with work in Victoria and Tasmania where they've asked questions on these types of issues, often in association with their health surveys. Next one, please. As I mentioned a little while ago, there is a lot of information available that's relevant to social capital. And it becomes much more meaningful if you can bring it together in a coherent way. So we've been working with others to develop a social capital framework. And the emphasis of this framework is presenting the concept of social capital as attributes of networks. And I'll show you a diagram in a few moments. At the end of that slide, I've got I've listed the publication that this work is actually presented in. It's catalogue number 1378.0 if you want to look it up. Next one, please. People often think of capital in four different forms: natural capital, economic capital, human capital, and social capital. So this diagram is just presenting where social capital fits in that context. And at the very bottom of that, you can see the words areas of individual community well-being. And the way we're trying to measure capital, social capital, links individual and community well-being to the attributes of social capital. Next slide, please. Even though in introduction I was given a lot of credit for leading this work, I probably shouldn't take that credit. It was really staff of the ABS. I guess it's more encouragement than leading. But here's the diagram that I did want to refer to. As I said a few moments ago, social capital revolves around networks. And a lot of the work we're doing is to try to describe those networks. Network type. And if you keep going down, you can see the words actors, relating units. They're the people who actually participate in the networks, the types of transactions networks undertake, their qualities, the structure of a network. So that's the underpinnings of a work on social capital. And we also link to other things like culture, legal conditions, institutional conditions, political conditions. And in this framework, we're trying to measure both the positive and negative effects of social capital. It's mostly positive, but there are negative effects. It's not hard to think of networks that haven't necessarily been good for society, and I guess the mafia is one that often comes to mind. It's a very powerful network, but doesn't always deliver positive things. Next one. I'll skip that one, given the time. International work on social capital. As I said, people are really in the experimental stage. Canada ran a community engagement survey 2 or 3 years ago. And if you're interested, there's quite a bit of information available on the Statistics Canada website. United Kingdom has been doing some interesting work as well. In one of their surveys, they ran what they call neighbourhood perceptions, measuring neighbourhood perceptions. And they've also got a new statistical database called Neighbourhood Statistics, which I'll come back to in a few moments. There is also a consortium of universities in Europe which run an annual survey on social cohesion and values. So there's a lot of international work going on, mainly in the more developed parts of the world. Next slide, please. The UK neighbourhood statistics was, I found particularly interesting because it was a UK government initiative. It wasn't an initiative of statisticians. It actually was coming from the government down. And they're very keen to have good quality information available at the neighbourhood level. One, to guide policymakers to make sure resources were being spent wisely, but also to facilitate a bit of self-help, that neighbourhoods actually had information about their own neighbourhood and how they compared with other neighbourhoods, with a hope that that information would help them collectively make decisions and do things that would improve their neighbourhoods. So for those sorts of reasons, this was it was an initiative of the UK government that they spent quite a bit of money on. It is a database of small area data, and it's also supported by a range of analytical and presentation tools so that it doesn't require a lot of know-how to be able to access this information. And even though it's the Office of National Statistics in the United Kingdom that manages this database, it did require partnerships with other data providers. And sometimes people get a bit possessive about their own data and don't like sharing it with people like the Australian Bureau of Statistics. But because this development had some real clout from the government, they were able to enforce those partnerships that were necessary to provide a full range of data. Next slide, please. The thing I wanted you to focus on is the white bit to the left of those charts. Basically, the top line is for large cities, those at more than a million. And the bottom one is for rural and small towns and different sized communities in the intervening bars. And not unexpectedly, you can see that the sense of belonging to a local community strengthens as the communities get smaller. Not a surprising result, but I guess the thing that I found a little bit surprising is that the differences weren't all that great between on the first four bars. Once you seem to get above 50,000, it doesn't seem to be the sense of belonging doesn't seem to change all that much. Next slide, please. The book done by the Victorian Department of Communities showed some striking differences between local government areas in rural and metropolitan areas. In fact, the differences seem much higher than the Canadian data I just showed you. Rural areas score much higher on community strength, but as I will mention in a few moments, there are also some downsides. In terms of community strength, they were using the types of variables that were I've mentioned on the slide. Percentages say they feel valued by society, percentages say they feel there are opportunities to have a say on issues that are important, percentage who volunteer, percentage who participate in decision-making boards or committees, percentage who say they can get help from family and friends. They're the sorts of variables that the study used to show that there was more community strength in rural areas than in the city areas. Next slide. In our general social survey data we ran in 2002, we also found that smaller communities were different in some ways. They had stronger feelings of safety. And also in terms of being asked for help or small favours, that was also stronger in the rural communities. In fact, the populations where people felt they couldn't ask for help or small favours were greatest in our two biggest cities, Sydney and Melbourne. But interestingly, the opposite is true when it comes to money. One of the questions we asked about people who whether they could raise $2,000 in cases of real need, that was actually smallest in the smaller communities. So even though people were more prepared to help, they were less able to give money, and that's no doubt due to the lower level of financial assets that are available in those communities. Next one, please. This is just some data from United Kingdom, the United Kingdom study on neighbourhoods that I mentioned before. About 59% of people thought they were well informed about local affairs. The interesting number is the 50% who felt communities could influence decisions. That's quite a large number of people who feel communities can actually do that. And obviously it's an asset that people should take advantage of. The number who personally felt they could influence the decision was 26%, which is slightly higher than I expected, but still a lot lower than what it was when you talk about a community, a collective. 18% felt civically engaged. Their definition of civically engaged was yes to all of it, above three questions. It'd be interesting to see how that data compares with Australia. Next slide, please. Now, I now want to talk for a few moments about what's actually happening in terms of changes in our geographic communities. I'll just highlight a few things on this table. The first one is in New South Wales, capital Sydney, that's Sydney, of course, the very large negative number. So perhaps Bob Carr's comments about Sydney being full is having some impact. They seem to be going north. If you look at Queensland, there's significant positive numbers both for Brisbane and for the rest of Queensland. The other interesting one, and this is over 1996 to 2001, is quite a strong positive number in Tasmania for outside Hobart, 10,193. And more generally, there have been more people moving to the balance of state than what there are to the capital cities. So it's not people going to capital cities in net terms, it's people going away from the capital cities It is mostly what's known as the sea change, or been called as the sea change. It's people moving to coastal communities, not the inland communities. Next one, please. When I was looking at this table last night, I haven't got quite as much information on it as what I really should have, but I'll walk you through it. The first point I want to make is that if you look at the bottom two lines of that table, first of all, look at thinking of large population centres. I'll start with capital cities. About 65% of Australians live in capital cities, 60 to 65%. So you can see the numbers going across that row are a lot lower than that. About 25% live in large population centres, so the numbers going across there are larger than that, and about 10% live in country areas. So the sea change isn't people moving from the capital cities, it's not dominated by that, it's actually people moving from inland areas into coastal communities. The other interesting thing is, if you look at the bullet points below the table, is the new residents in the coastal areas tend to be younger rather than older. So the perception of older people moving from the capital cities to the coast isn't quite true. There's some of those, of course, but it's actually the more dominant group are younger adults who are actually moving from inland and rural areas. Using statistical jargon, I said new residents are less likely to be a couple family. Those are without children, so I guess in some people's eyes they're not really a family, but it's young adults who not yet have children which tend to dominate this group that are moving. They also are more likely to be employed and less likely to be born overseas. And those who are born overseas that are moving to coastal areas are dominated by the Anglo-Saxons, the from UK, New Zealand, and later to New Zealand and Ireland are the main three main groups. So the next one. Now this is having, I think, an impact on rural communities. If you look at, I'm colourblind, so if I get the colour slightly wrong, it's the pinky purple colour, I think. If you look at that, that refers to urban areas, and you can see in that younger adult groups that there's a lot higher proportion of young adults in the urban areas than what there are in the non-urban areas. In fact, that population pyramid, as we refer to it, has got a big indent among those young adults for non-urban areas. So compared with urban areas, the non-urban people tend to be a little bit older. If you look at the yellow bit at the top of the graph, and tend to have more children, you look at the yellow bit at the bottom graph, but there's this big inward bulge, if you like, among the young adults. And I think that's a worrying sign for those communities, because it's these sorts of people who often provide the vitality for communities and the vitality for the future and so forth. Next one. Thank you. This one is for the non-urban areas, comparing the coastal for inland. And the coastal, again, is that sort of pinky purple colour, and you can see that that coastal communities do have an older age profile, but the migration, internal migration, is tending to diminish that a bit. But even despite that, the coastal communities still tend to have an older age profile. Next one, please. Given the time, I won't go through everything here, but in our 2002 General Social Survey, I mentioned we collected some items related to social capital. I'll let you scan those, but they're the sorts of questions we asked. I'll just mention a few of them. Ability to ask for small favours, unpaid voluntary work, frequency of face-to-face contact with family and friends, and so forth. Next slide. We also... these are other questions we asked in the 2002 survey, and perhaps some of the more interesting ones, whether there's support in time of crisis and source of support. This is support from outside the household, and the ability to raise $2,000 within a week. We're looking at extending these questions in the 2006 survey, particularly in areas such as trust and civic participation. Next one, thanks. Okay, well, the extent of family community support, this is from our 2002 survey. 94% of people said they could get support in time of crisis from persons living outside the household. It sounds like a high number, but 6% of the people who can't is still probably, well, it is still too many. Particularly when you see that the range of support that was given a survey, friends, neighbours, family members, work colleagues, community charity, religious organisation, local council and other government services, health, legal, financial professionals. So there's a lot of different types of people there, yet 6% of people say they can't, they don't feel like they've got a source of support from any of those. The next thing I wanted to highlight was that in general, the main sources of support are friends, families first, friends second. Older people rely much more on family and neighbours, whereas younger people rely more on family and friends. So there is some difference depending on age. In terms of those that are using community charity or religious organisations, these are dominated not unexpectedly by the lowest income quintile. The other interesting thing is that these are a strong source of support outside the major cities, particularly for women. Next one, please. Voluntary work. If you look at the first column, that's the number of people who have undertake voluntary work. Classified by age. Not a huge amount of differences, though it's slightly higher in the middle age groups, 35 through to 64. Like Neville, I'm a 1946er, so I still think of myself as middle aged, so I can count 55 to 64 as a middle age group still. There's a couple of footnotes there. The extent of voluntary work is stronger outside capital cities. And there's also is a positive correlation with income. The more income people have got, the more likely they are to be involved in voluntary work. Now, in terms of the groups where voluntary work is highest, sport and recreation activities tend to dominate. If you're actually looking at welfare and community, which is the second column there, you can see that it's more in the older age groups where welfare community volunteering work is more prominent. In the 55 to 74 age range in particular. Next slide. Now, I've run through quite a bit of information fairly quickly, so I will attempt to summarise what the statistical conclusions are. It does appear that social capital is much stronger for communities outside capital cities, so that is an asset that could be utilised. Also, people believe communities can have an influence, another reason why we should actually work closely with communities. The sea change is real, though the movers are different to many perceptions. They're younger, and they also don't come from the capital cities by and large. They're coming from the inland areas. And this may well have some impact on the long-term well-being of rural communities. There's some real risk there, particularly the loss of young adults. The general social survey also shows that most people feel they could get support in time of crisis from persons living outside their household. Family and friends are the most important. But there is 6% who can't, and that's where we need to focus our effort. And if you break that 6% down by different types of ethnicity, family structure and whatnot, you'll find that people like Indigenous and single parents are among those who are most in, or at least able to get need from outside the household. Next slide. And this is my last one. How can the ABS help measure community strength? I haven't mentioned there, but we're hoping that this framework on social capital that we have developed will be an asset, because we're in the process of loading data to it, and we're not looking just at ABS data, we're looking to incorporate data that's available from a whole range of different sources. So by having that database, we're hoping that we'll have a cohesive set of data, a one-stop shop, if you like, on social capital that people can use. And we would also link to the databases that provide the more detailed data. We are extending the information that's available in the field of social capital from the next population census, the next general social survey. They're the two main initiatives. Now, in the context of people running more community-level surveys, I think what we can do is provide some benchmark data so people can actually see how their own community sits with other communities, how it compares with average communities and the distribution indeed. We could also help provide some survey models, some survey instruments and guidelines on how to run a good survey that could be used by communities who want to run their own surveys of community strength. And also, I think there is scope for us to to work more closely with the research community. Here I'm not just talking about people who work in universities, but people who work in NGOs and in government agencies of various types, to actually analyse the link between the strength of communities and other outcome, economic, social, environmental outcomes. There's a lot of data there. It is being underutilised, and if we can help that data being utilised, I think we're making a contribution. So thank you for listening, and thank you for inviting me, Rhonda. When I accept the invitation, I was expecting about this many people, not that many people, but I'm particularly pleased to have been asked to come along. Thank you.